Good evening. James McCanny here with my Science Hour, September 16th, 2010. And tonight's main science topic, I got to make an adjustment here on the sound on my end. Okay, tonight's main science topic will be dealing with the Old North Pole. Now, this is not the one where Santa Claus lives, but this is the one before the Holocene period, which was about, well, they estimate 12,000 years ago. Other people think it was much more recent. But I'm not going to argue dates, the geological term. Let's talk about ice ages just for a minute here. The Pleistocene era lasted from about 2.5 million, with an M, million years ago, up to about 12,000 years ago. So we are right on the edge, so to speak. 12,000 years is a very short time in geological time. So we are right on the edge of a mass extinction. And that was, let me go through the list of animals that went extinct. The Neanderthal man went extinct during that time. But then large mammals, mammoths, mastodons, saber-toothed cats, glyptodons, ground sloths, Irish elk, cave bears, and short-faced bears all went extinct. That means those were big animals. They died off because after the catastrophe, there was simply not enough food to support them. And so it was also a very hard time. A lot of them probably died in the catastrophe. But right there about, let's say 12,000 years ago, but I think it was more recent. But anyway, we'll use the geological dating just for fun tonight. But about 12,000 years ago was this mass extinction. There's no doubt about it. It happened. And so at the same time, oddly enough, most of the volcanoes in the world were going off. Isn't that interesting? What would cause an ice age to occur simultaneously with volcanoes going off? And then also some very strange things happened. Of course, the mastodons who were living in what we now call Siberia, that was a rather semi-tropical moderate climate at the time. It got shifted up to where it is now. And so when you look at maps of the old, what they called the Laurentian ice cap, it was skewed according to our current North Pole geometry on Earth. It was skewed over almost down to North America, covering much of Canada, of what is now Canada, and going down in through Minnesota into Iowa, and then all of the border states, Iowa, out the Dakotas, Montana, Idaho, out to Washington State, and then easterly covering all the Great Lakes, and then swooping down into northern Illinois, Indiana, and up through the northeastern states of New York, and up through Maine, Nova Scotia, and then, of course, as I said, all of Canada. All of Canada was covered. So at any rate, and also some of the big islands that are out in the Atlantic had glaciation. But anyway, the point is something major happened. And in front of me, I have a map that I've been kind of guarding. It's a beautiful, huge map. And so I'm going to have to, I want to read from this map tonight and what it says. It comes from the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and this is what you'll see is some very interesting statements about that time period. And so from the transition between the Pleistocene and the Holocene, and that is about 12,000 years ago. So I said the Earth went on and on. It had many glaciation periods during that 2.5 million year period, but nothing where you had a major Earth cleansing, so to speak. And that's when the Venus comet event occurred. That's when as far as we're concerned, it's the most formative event in the history of man. Oddly enough, it's denied by all modern teachings. So anyway, I'll get into that topic as the main science topic. First of all, I want to talk about a couple of announcements here. First of all, I just want to remind everybody where this show airs. It's 6 p.m. All these times are going to be Central Time. Central Daylight Time. We're in Daylight Savings Time now. So these are all Central. And, of course, if you switch to Standard Time, the only thing that changes is Arizona. And I think Hawaii is in that also, where they don't change to Daylight Savings Time. But anyway, 6 p.m. Thursday evenings, frequency 9.350, and also the streaming on Tower 2 on WWCR. Then 2 hours later, 8 p.m. on Thursday evening, on the internet streaming, realityradionetwork.com, that carries this same show, re-airs it. Then on Friday night, at 10 p.m., Central Daylight Time, frequency 5.755, and also you can get the streaming on a web page, Scriptures, that's plural, Scriptures for America. And there's a listen online link there. Also, 3 a.m. Saturday morning, once again, frequency 5.755, that's shortwave megahertz, that is, and the same show airs there. And so that's a really good collage of times and places and frequencies to listen to this show. Also, it is heard on Galaxy Satellite, Galaxy 25. And you can get all the details of that on my webpage, jmccsci.com. I'll give that again a little later. And then, of course, many, 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 many people listen to the archive on my webpage. Lots of people will pick it up there in MP3 format and download it and listen on their iPod while they're exercising or sitting in a chair or trying to go to sleep at night. I wonder how many people I put to sleep at night by listening to their iPods after hours. Well, I hope not too many. At any rate, those are the times and places to listen to this show. Now, last Monday night, I was on the Coast to Coast AM show with host George Norrie, a show that I've been on countless times. I don't even know how many times I've been on that show as a guest. And introducing on that show my new book, The Diamond Principle. And then I had the way the show works is the first hour is many times announcements and news items. It's a four-hour-long show. The second to the fourth hour, I was on the first of those of the 3 hours by myself with George Norrie. And then a man named Howard Bloom came on. And he contributed during the second hour, and we were co-guests at that point, chatting about the topic of going into outer space and populating outer space. And that's one of the topics in my new book, The Diamond Principle. And then the third hour, we took questions. And so if you missed that show, go back and catch the archive, because it's really, I thought it was an excellent show. It's always interesting from my perspective because before the show, I was pretty tired. I had a long 2 days, and I'm like, whoa, how am I going to deal with this? And when the clock struck one here at Central Time, and I was on the phone getting mic'd up and getting the power levels ready and everything, all of a sudden, I just gained that surge of energy, and there we were. 3 hours later, I could have run a 3-minute mile, I think. It was a great show, a lot of energy, a lot of great topics, and it was very fun to be co-host with Howard Bloom, because he has a lot of energy and is very interested in the topic of getting us, all of us, not just three astronauts, but all of us, to go into outer space. And it's really a huge, important topic. It's probably the most important topic on the planet because it branches off into so many other avenues, like social avenues. Are we a social enough being to go into outer space and have 1 million people in a space colony? What do you think about that? Can we shed our need for policing? Can we shed our need for the monetary system, that the economic system that we're bound to on Earth, a lot of things would have to change because there's really no place to spend money in outer space. And one of my points in the Diamond Principle is these cities, maybe not all of them, but at least some of them, have to be completely autonomous. In other words, if they have a repair, they have to get the materials from outer space. They can't depend on some manufacturer on Earth getting the replacement parts out to them. Everything has to be done out there. And that's a big order. So you can see that we're not going to do that tomorrow. But if we don't, then one very simple result will occur, and that will be the demise, the complete demise of the human race as we know it. And we would be just a failed, we'd be no better than the Neanderthal man who went under, the Neanderthal man not getting into outer space, at least as far as we know. And before then, it appears there were some advanced civilizations on Earth. The Atlantis, the island continent of Mu, Lemuria, and probably some other places, but maybe some advanced technologies back there, very likely. But at any rate, that was last Monday, September 13th, Coast to Coast AM. If you missed it, make sure you go get that show and replay it. There's you go to the Coast to Coast website and just get the archive and play that. It was a great show and one that I was very happy to be part of. Okay, talking about hurricanes. Well, we've got Igor, Julia, and Carl all in the Atlantic right now. So what's my opinion? Some people are saying, see, we're having a normal hurricane season after all. Well, actually, these are still relatively weak storms. They are not what you'd call major hurricanes, but the other thing is they are simply moving north into the Atlantic harmlessly, except for Carl. And I'm sure that if somebody's living right now in the Yucatan Peninsula or around Campeche or south of Veracruz in Mexico, they're probably not thinking that this is a mild storm, but they're getting rain. 80-mile-an-hour winds, that's significant if you live in the kind of housing that you have down there. And not that I'm criticizing that housing. Mind you, I love those houses. It's a beautiful place to be, and it's very wonderful living in those towns, and especially the little towns that dot the coastline down there through southeastern Mexico. But in a storm, they don't hold up quite as well as, other houses built with a bit more stable construction. But at any rate, the point I want to make here is what is happening, and this is the difficult part about predicting hurricanes. Now, at the beginning of the hurricane season, I said that this would be a very weak, almost non-eventful hurricane season. And really, it has been. We've had some tropical storms. Carl is a hurricane by the stretch of its chinny-chin-chin. And probably should be simply categorized a tropical storm. But you know NOAA, they need their stats. And they probably got some fans down there plugged in trying to get that extra 0.001 mile per hour so they can call it a hurricane to get their stats up. But really, it's been a very weak season, and these storms are weak in that they curve northwards into the Atlantic and are harmless. That's an indication of weak storms. But what's causing this little flurry of storm activity? Well, a couple days ago on the 10th of September, the sun had some very bursty activity. Now, understand that something I discovered a long time ago, and it's in the weather book, is that it's not the strength of the solar wind, it's not the strength of the current levels coming by Earth and its magnetic field, our protective magnetic field. It's the change, it's the rapid change that causes the rapid fluctuation in the solar wind, the dynamic pressure, the rate of flow, the number of protons versus number of electrons, and that rapid change is what buffets, so to speak, our atmosphere, causing these storms. And so right now we're coming out of the August return current sheet, which gives us that active peak in the month of August, early September, which we're in right now, really. But we're coming out of that. And so as we come out of that, remember that the August return current sheet is a current sheet of protons that flows back towards the sun. Because in the overall solar wind, you have an excess current of protons coming out from the sun. That can't happen forever, so you need a continuous loop circuit. And so the proton return current comes back to the sun in the location where we are, Earth, that is, in the month of August. That's why the auroras peak in the month of August. That's why the hurricanes peak in the month of August. That's why tornadoes peak in the month of August, because we have this return current sheet that's driving our weather kind of backwards in terms of the current, the normal current flow in the solar system, but still very active time, but in a very high energy flow time in rapid change. But now we're coming out of that. So the regular solar wind, it would be like, let's imagine this. Imagine you had two streams. One was going north and one was going south. And they're fairly rapidly moving streams of water, like rivers, let's say. But let's say there's some times where those rivers come together and meet. In other words, one river is flowing south, one river is flowing north, but they're touching. And so in that turbulence, in that period of time when you're in that turbulence between the river going north and the river going south, then you're going to experience a lot of activity. And that's where we are right now, except in the solar system situation, the proton return current, that August return current sheet, is coming back towards the sun where the regular solar wind is coming out from the sun. Then you throw in a September 10th bursty storm activity on the sun and you get hurricanes. That's what happens. If it weren't for that type of activity, these hurricanes wouldn't be happening. But the point is, this is the type of thing that's impossible to forecast in the type of forecasting that I do. The bursty activity on the sun, you could have guessed that during this time there would be some kind of activity. But you have to remember, too, that the August return current sheet is centralized in the month of August. It can whip around. It's like a big snake out there, whipping back and forth. So sometimes it's as early as July where we're in the thick of it, and sometimes as late as September when we're in the thick of it. So at any rate, those kind of things are hard to predict, and we certainly don't have the satellite technology out there that would allow you to measure these conditions. But at any rate, that's what's going on in the world of weather. The sun also right now has a B-class storm, B as in boy, and it's a very mild storm. It's got some electron activity going on. I won't go into detail on that, but basically, we have a mild storm condition passing by us that is occurring on the sun. And it can take a few days for that solar wind to get to us if it's moving at an average speed. Sometimes it can get to us in a matter of a few minutes. If the protons are coming out, cosmic rays they're called, they're relativistic speed protons, and those have been detected coming out of the sun. And so they will arrive with the light, or just a dash behind the light, that like you'll see a major event on the sun. And just behind that event, because you're seeing the light that came from the sun like 8 minutes ago, just behind that light event that you can detect in your telescope or your solar telescope, just behind that is a rush of protons. And so those protons are coming out at near the speed of light. So very high energy activity. But right now we're in a B-class storm, which is a relatively mild solar storm. Well, let's see. That's about it for the weather situation. So I'll go right into the topic of the North Pole. And this is something, let me just quick give a little information on the book. And then I'll give this at the end of the show also. The book, The Diamond Principle, is available now. That's my latest book, sixth in a series. The original books, The Planet X Comets and Earth Changes, is the first book. Surviving Planet X Passage is the second book. Atlantis to Tesla, The Colburn Connection, is the third book. The weather book, Principia Meteorologia, The Physics of Sun-Earth Weather, is the fourth book. The Calculate Primes book, teaching you how to calculate primes directly with the generator function, a generator function which I developed a mathematical technique for directly calculating prime numbers. And then the latest book, The Diamond Principle. And when, by the way, when you look at my books and the progression, each one took a 90-degree turn from the previous ones, but each book incorporates everything in the previous book. So that gives you an idea of the wide range of topics that I cover with my work. But The Diamond Principle, once again, it's somewhat of a social analysis of the human race. But then it goes into the paths and the mechanisms that nature has given us in the electrical situation in the universe to ride these for free to go to other stars. I call them the electric highways to the stars, a topic that I built decades ago, I guess. But the concept of riding electric propulsion systems to into space and then to the other planets and then to the stars. So anyway, The Diamond Principle, the cost of the book is $11.95, but for one book, I charge shipping, so it's $16.90, or just remember, $17. One book, that includes shipping. But you can, if you buy two books, you get free shipping. So that means for $23.90, you get two books and free shipping. And so the two options are $17 for one book, $24 for two books. The mail order address, J, M as in Mary, CC, P.O. Box 58, Navarre, N-A-V-A-R-R-E, Minnesota, 55364, JMCC, P.O. Box 58, Navarre, N-A-V-A-R-R-E, Minnesota, 55364. And you can order that. Or the water filters. I'm not going to go into that tonight. Enough commercial time. I don't like commercials, but I just want to promote my book and make sure everybody out there gets a chance to grab it. And it's only available on my webpage. I don't like Amazon, all the other pages. Won't tell you why, but you might guess why. Okay, on to the old North Pole. Now, if Santa has taken up residence at our current North Pole, I wonder if he used to live at the old North Pole. He had to move at the same time of this Earth-wide disaster. And there was a pole shift. And about, I would say about 35 degrees, maybe anywhere, it could have been as little as 15 degrees, but it could have been as much as 35 degrees. In other words, the pole shifted, so guess what happened to the old polar cap? It melted, and very quickly it would melt, and then the water would go rushing down till it hit the ocean. Well, it just turns out that the Pleistocene era, that is from 2.5 million to 12,000 years ago, using geological standard aging, 2.5 million to 12,000 years ago, so you're talking really around 2.5 million years that the Earth was relatively stable, all of a sudden, all these things happen, including a pole shift. Now, it always amazes me. That scientists with training, I don't care if they're in geology or biology or physicists or chemists or whatever, if they look at the map of the world during the Pleistocene period, what do you see? The ocean levels are 300 feet below the current levels. Known fact. This is not, goofy science. This isn't something that somebody's making up that's got a website and trying to pretend to be a science. These are hard facts. All the volcanoes in the world went off at the same time, about at the beginning of this Pleistocene, at the beginning of the Holocene period, at the end of the Pleistocene. we had a mass extinction. Along with that mass extinction, many of the big animals have been found peppered with microdiamonds in the side that's up. In other words, as they fell down in the side of a riverbed or wherever they were found, they were peppered as if you took a pepper shaker and shook it all over them, but it was diamonds, microdiamonds. So these things had to come in from outer space. There's no other source to give you that type of effect. And this is all over the world. One of the points I make in the diamond principle in the book is that diamonds come from the sunward nose side of comets, the high-intensity electron beam on the nose side of comets. And I explain how that works and why Earth diamonds are found deep in the core. Those formed when Earth was a young prototype planet, experiencing the electron beam to the nose, to the sunward side during its formative stages. And then those diamonds were formed there. One of the contradictions, one of the big contradictions, is that diamonds come up these flux tubes and then they're found, and so they're known to come from deep in the Earth. But when you find them, they're in very soft material. And diamonds, in the standard process of making a diamond, you need tremendous, tremendous pressures. So how did this soft material provide high pressure to the carbon that eventually was to become the diamond? It doesn't make sense. It doesn't compute. It doesn't work. If you're going to make a diamond with a artificial process, then you need a bed to do it. With a very hard surface and a compression, a mechanism that gets a very hard surface and locks the carbon material in the middle. I was just testing the signal there, so excuse me for, but the signal looks pretty good tonight, as far as I can tell, in my studio here. At any rate, so let's go back to the North Pole. All of these events happened at that same time. Standard science wants you to believe that the Earth just jumped up and did this all by itself. Volcanoes went off, earthquakes, the mountain ranges formed, and of course a lot of that is denied, but I want to read this to you. Now, what I'm going to read to you is not out of Velikovsky. It's not out of my books. It's not out of anybody that you might consider controversial. I'm going to tell you where this comes from. I've got this giant map that I told you about. This is the glacial Lake Missoula, which is up north in north of Montana and in Canada. It says this is a map. It's beautiful colored, three-colored map. Or I bet this is probably a four-color process. Glacial Lake Missoula and the channeled Scabland. It's called Scabland. That covers much of Washington State and Oregon State. And guess who put this map out? This comes from the U.S. Department of Agriculture, the United States Forest Service. And down in the lower left-hand corner, it shows the extent of the continental ice during the last ice age. There's none in Russia. Interesting. Gee, there's really not much in Alaska either. How could that be? Most of it sits basically on the top of what we now call Canada. And as I said, it extends down through Minnesota. Minnesota took the whole state of Minnesota basically, except maybe the southwestern part, was covered and glaciated. And then it does not extend down any farther than maybe just a hair into Missouri, I'm not sure. But the point is, the old North Pole is not, or was not, where the current North Pole is. It's off. You take the center, more or less, of where the center of this old North Pole was. And it was north, probably in the state of Ontario. I always say north of the state of Michigan. It could have been a little bit west of there, north of the state of Minnesota, about halfway up into the Canadian, probably into Ontario. That's the center of the Laurentian ice cap. That's the ice cap that preceded the Holocene period. That's the ice cap that formed the Great Lakes. Remember that All the oceans of the world have salt in them. Where did that salt come from? It slowly rained in from outer space, causing these areas to become salty, these oceans. Well, and you have oceans or seas in the Mideast, the very salty seas, and of course the United States has its very own, the salt lake beds, very salty area that dried up. Well, what happens when water evaporates out of a salt bed or a salty area? The salt concentration gets higher and higher and higher until living things simply can't live in it. But at any rate, the point is that the Laurentian ice cap covered all of what we now call the Great Lakes. So they are very recent. All of the glaciated lakes of Minnesota, the land of 10,000 lakes, many of the lakes out in the northwest United States, along the border, along Montana, all the way out to Washington State. All of these very freshwater lakes. Where did those come from? Why don't they have any salt? Because they're new. That's why. Because they're new. New. Not old. So anyway, this map is a beautiful map. And it's about a 5 foot by a 4 foot map. So I'm struggling with it here in my studio. But I'm going to read what it says. Now, remember, this is from the United States Forest Service. Once again, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, United States Forest Service. I'm going to read what it says here in big, bold letters at the bottom of this map. And now the main part of the map, there's a little section that shows the Laurentian ice cap that covers that part of the world. But then the map itself is of this Missoula Lake and Wash and Scabland area that basically starts at about Idaho, the state of Idaho, what we would call Idaho, and then west, all the way through Washington State, through Oregon. And if you've ever been out there, it's just a wash. You can see where the water came through tremendously fast and hard. Okay, so I'm reading off the map now in bold print down at the bottom. Between 15,000 and 12,000 years ago, tremendous, nearly unimaginable floods scoured channels, back-flushed rivers, and ponded in temporary lakes across almost 16,000 square miles of the Pacific Northwest. This is of the United States, of course. The evidence for more than 40 of these cataclysms appears in the distinctive geologic record of Washington, Idaho, Oregon, and Western Montana. I'm going to read that sentence again. The evidence for more than 40, you hear that number? 40, that's 40. It's not 4, it's 40. The evidence for more than 40 of these cataclysms appears in the distinctive geological record of Washington, Idaho, Oregon, and Western Montana. 40 of these events occurred, it's telling us. Okay, and then it continues. The Ice Age floods carved the huge, bare basalt channels and dry falls, stranded massive boulders far from their bedrock source, and deposited gravel bars and current ripples. These are ripples of like sand and gravel that look like ripples from where they were deposited, whose fantastic scale dwarfs their modern counterparts. Now, I've got a CD that I sell. It's a CD of the American Southwest, the aerial photos, and you can see the same type of wash all the way down through those states. The state of New Mexico has a big central area where there's just a wash area that's probably 50, 70 miles wide, where these massive amounts of water came pouring through there. Okay, I'm going to continue reading here, because this is just amazing. Geologist J. Harlan Bretz was the first to piece together the flood story from his work in Washington's channeled scablands. His outrageous hypothesis, and outrageous hypothesis is in quotes, his outrageous hypothesis proposed in 1923 ran directly counter to the prevailing uniformitarian doctrine, the idea that the present world was shaped by minor forces of erosion and deposition working over great lengths of time. Bretz's flood story touched off a running firefight that enveloped the geologic community for 20 years, with a few diehard geologists holding the uniformitarian line for another 10. This is almost like Galileo or Copernicus trying to say that the Earth is not the center of the solar system. Okay, this is the last paragraph now. This is in bold letters down at the bottom of this big, beautiful map. It was J.T. Pardee's work on Glacial Lake Missoula that provided vindication for Bretz's catastrophic flood hypothesis. In 1942, Pardee published his evidence for rapid outflow of Lake Missoula's over 500 cubic miles of water. 500 cubic miles. You want to just stop and think of that. 500 cubic miles. 1 cubic mile would be a cube, a mile on a side, a cube. This is 500 of those. Okay, now listen to what happened. The lake had been impounded behind the glacier that moves south down the Purcell Trench in Idaho, damming the Clark Fork River near the site of the present Lake Pend Oriel. Ice, however, makes a notoriously lousy dam, primarily because it floats. When the ice dam failed, the floodwaters were released in a raging torrent. Pardee estimated that Lake Missoula drained at a maximum rate of 9.5 cubic miles an hour. 9.5 cubic miles per hour. That's, it says here, 387 million cubic feet per second. 380, you know, these are numbers that are so big. You cannot imagine. But here they give an example. They give something to compare this to. I'm going to read this over. Pardee estimated that Lake Missoula drained at a maximum rate of 9.5 cubic miles an hour, 387 million cubic feet per second. Now listen to this. 10 times the combined flow of all the world's rivers. So if you took all the rivers in the world and took their collective flow, this single flow that came out of this Missoula glaciated area north of Montana, Idaho, and flowed down through those states in a matter of a couple days, that was the equivalent to all of the rivers of the world all flowing through that area at one time, but not just equal to that, 10 times that amount of water. Excuse me. This is amazing. So if you want to take a fun trip and see some real interesting topography of the planet Earth, go there. Or even if you go down through New Mexico, Arizona, western Texas, for example, you see those big washes. But if you're lucky enough to fly over that area, especially from a high altitude, or if not, just buy my CD. The CD is relatively inexpensive. It's called the 110 aerial photography or photos, aerial photos of the American Southwest. 110 photos and taken from 45,000 foot altitude. We started out at early morning from Los Angeles and or near Los Angeles and flew to Denver. And that morning was very clear. And the original purpose of the flight was to look at the haze layers, because at that time China was having, and Africa, was, they were both having tremendous dust storms. This red dust was blowing across, and it was way up in the upper stratosphere. So anyway, the point was to, at dawn, or before dawn, get up to a 45,000 altitude and look out into space above and look down to the ground, and I was doing the photography myself. And so then all of a sudden I realized we checked the weather and it was clear like that, absolutely crystal clear, probably about a 300 to 400 mile, very clear visibility that morning. It was a winter morning. And so we flew all the way to Denver, and I was able to take pictures out the bottom of the airplane and off to the north side. And so you have the entire American Southwest on high resolution film. Or these are digital, it's digital of course. And you can zoom into those pictures, and oh, it's just incredible. And then you can look up above the horizon and look up into darkness above. It was absolutely amazing day of flying. But to capture that all on film so you can see it, amazing. But also, the point I wanted to make is when you get over New Mexico, you see those big wash areas that come out of Green River, Utah, that far south where that water came rushing down and just deposited sand and gravel and boulders and left those spires, those big parks down there that have the spires, all of that washed out in a very short period of time. So at any rate, now let's talk about what really happened back there. And just remember that the ocean levels were 300 feet below what they are now. So the coastal areas, if you were in Florida right now, you would have about a 200 to 300 mile coastal plateau that you would walk out before you got to the beach. And the same to the west. If you have my Atlantis to Tesla book, look in the front. I have a picture of the entire Gulf area of the Gulf of Mexico and Florida, and you can see how the topography is, how those continental shelves go out and then drop off. That was all above water at that time. So our land mass shrunk tremendously. I would guess also there are probably vast cities that were populated out somewhere along those coastlines. Possibly many of them have crumbled down into the abyss ever since then. But the point is that at that time, that interface between the Pleistocene and the Holocene, the Pleistocene being that 2.5 million year period, when the Earth was relatively stable, that's where the mastodons, those big, the sloth, the giant elk, that's where they had evolved. And so all of a sudden, one day, I would say one day, or in a very short period of time, this all came tumbling down. Neanderthal man went under, and out came modern, what we call modern man, a smarter, sleeker, better tuned, possibly more intelligent. I hope we're more intelligent than Neanderthal man, but maybe we're not. At any rate, that's, to me, very interesting. But let's talk about what happened here. How did this pole shift occur? The situation is as follows. Imagine the Earth as an egg, a soft-boiled egg. And there's an experiment you can do. You can do it in your kitchen. You can actually do this experiment at home. It can be recommended. So you boil an egg, hard boil it, and then you take just a regular soft egg, and you put them on a counter, and you ask somebody if they can tell the difference between the hard-boiled egg and the soft-boiled egg. And by looking at them, you really can't tell the difference. But by spinning them, if you spin the hard-boiled egg, it continues to spin because the torque put on the inner part of the egg is solid, so it's attached to the shell and solid all the way through. So when you spin it, all of the solid part in the middle spins too. Take the soft egg, spin it, and it very quickly stops spinning. And the reason for that is because when you spin the shell, the inside part does not spin. It wants to just sit there. And so what's going to happen? The viscosity between the egg and the egg liquid in the middle and the shell interact and very quickly slows down the shell. So Earth is very much like this. Earth has a crust and a mantle. That's the outer part of Earth. And then there's a somewhat viscous layer where you've got a lot of hot and molten materials. That's what comes out of volcanoes. That's the layer that volcanic lava comes from. Okay, now, below that, the Earth is relatively solid just because gravitational pressure holds it together, and there's really not a lot of liquid, what you would call liquid down there. It's mainly a solid. So you have, instead of the soft-boiled egg, imagine that you have a hard-boiled egg, but the layer right next to the shell is soft. That's what Earth is like. And then the shell on the outside is rigid. So now when you spin your egg, the inside, the solid part of the egg doesn't spin really, but it does get a little bit of a torque from the spin, and then all of a sudden, in the outside of the egg, the shell is going to spin quickly, but then stop very rapidly. It's not going to continue spinning. So that's the situation with Earth. It's kind of like a soft boiled egg, and it's kind of like a hard boiled egg. It's got the mantle or the crust, which would be the equivalent of the shell, inside a little bit of a viscous layer, and then hardcore down in the middle, all the way rest of the down to the center of the Earth. Okay, so at any rate, now here comes the big comet nucleus, the nucleus that extracted the atmosphere off of Mars. It took the oceans and atmosphere off of Mars, so this object was a bit bigger gravitationally than Mars, but when it came by Earth, gravity was a bit larger, and we're talking about Venus. If you look at the size of Venus, the planet today, it's bigger than Mars, but smaller than Earth. So gravitationally, when it came by Mars, it had enough pull to pull off, as they linked together gravitationally, it had enough pull to drag the atmosphere literally off of Mars, and then without the atmosphere, the ocean would evaporate very quickly. Because there's no pressure, there's no atmospheric pressure there to hold it in place. So literally, in a night, in from what Velikovsky says, the ancients saw this. Mars was a blue planet. That's where Baal came from. There were people, according to history, residing on Mars. But at any rate, that's, to me, a speculation, but there's a hint of truth to that. And those people took off, and they landed in an area of Eastern Europe. That's the story. That's a historical story. But whether it's true or not, I can't say. I wasn't there. But what I'm telling you is that the whole idea that as this object, Venus the comet, came through, and remember, comets are not dirty snowballs. They are the discharge of the solar capacitor, and they're drawing in the tail material. They have a nose sunward spike, electron spike coming from the sun. Makes them a very high intensity electrical device out there. Basically an electrical vacuum cleaner in outer space. So the big tail is the material being drawn in. Okay, now Earth passes near this large comet nucleus. We also go through the comet tail and pick up a lot of water. We're there for about 40 days and 40 nights. We get the hydrocarbons. They come burning into the atmosphere because of the electrical discharges. They have oxygen. They start snapping and burning. And then you have the blitz of rock, the meteor stream that goes along with the comet, and the barrage of microdiamonds, which are forming in the nose area of the comet, and that high-energy electron beam with carbon gas. This is all explained in the diamond principle. But at any rate, the point is that the gravitational wave of this object coming by wrenches Earth's crust. Just like you're taking the spinning egg and you flip it, that's what happened to Earth, and that's what caused the Earth's crust and mantle to flip about 15 degrees, and then they continued to rotate in the same direction as the original inside part of the Earth, but what happened is the North Polar Cap now is about 15 to 30 degrees offset. Well, gee, guess what? It's gonna warm up and it's gonna melt very quickly. Other parts of the world are going to experience glaciation. We've just lost the sun for 40 days and 40 nights. The Earth spinning around has lost that energy. So we entered into an ice age. It was tremendously difficult times, and the biggest animals could not survive that devastation. They could not survive the cold, the lack of food. I'm looking at some of the other animals here, a woolly rhinoceros. Ooh, I don't think I'd want to talk to that animal in a dark alley. But, and there were, other forms of small wild horses, At any rate, all of these animals went extinct at that time. They were large animals because they had had 2.5 million years to develop. Now, once again, this event at the break of the Pleistocene, the beginning of the Holocene period, took a fairly short amount of time geologically and caused a mass extinction. The volcanoes were going off. The pole had shifted. The Laurentian ice cap melted, washed down through what is now Washington State and Oregon and Idaho, causing this tremendous flash flood. Some of it settled into the ground, into what now is the Oglala Reservoir north of Nebraska, all the way up to Winnipeg, that formed the Great Lakes. The residue of the melt formed the Great Lakes with no salt in them because they had been protected from the Laurentian ice sheet had been there for a very long time. Now, it appears that this type of event has happened many times, and in the little write-up on this map from the U.S. Forest Service, it says that the geological record in those states indicates, and this is not some guy just talking, this is the geological record according to the geologists that work in that area. This occurred 40 times. There are 40 different epochs of geological record up in that northwestern sector of the United States. 40 different epochs of glaciation, melting, erosion, large-scale catastrophic melting where it washed down and caused these various flood conditions. When the first naturalists came across the plains, the western plains of the United States, they all reported there was flooding, there were signs of ancient floods everywhere. You know, and you have trees, big trees, far away from where they would have grown and just piled up there. You know, the things that would have gone away given enough time. But it was all very obvious, and the one thing Velikovsky, a very good point he made, was that by the year 1900, all of this had been destroyed by man, for firewood, for whatever, development, digging things up, making roads, all of this evidence of the ancient floods had been erased by man's development efforts. So it's easy now for scholars who sit in ivory towers and probably rarely venture out to see such things, it's easy for them to sit in their ivory towers and say this never happened, and, you know, drink their morning coffee. But the reality is that if you read the old naturalists, like Ignatius Donnelly is a great one. If you have not read Ignatius Donnelly's book, The Antediluvian World, you really should. Another great example he brings up, he grew up in Pennsylvania in the coal fields of Pennsylvania. And he said the coal was layered down and then there would be a layer of gravel, then another layer of coal, then another layer of gravel. It was layered as if something came along and just laid it out, and then a gravel came and was laid on top of it, and then later another layer of coal. Some kind of process was going on here. Now, what's interesting here is this 40 times that this has happened on a somewhat regular basis. Well, gee, I wonder if there could be something out there that comes into the solar system on a regular basis. Maybe it doesn't affect Earth in a terrible way each time, but it has some effect on it. Enough to cause a notice, enough to be noticeable in the geological record. Now, these are geologists who don't believe, you know, I'm sure that they don't really understand, nor do they, I'm not sure what they understand. But all I'm saying is that these geologists see 40 different epochs or records of events in the geological history. And I know I was at some meetings, the American Geophysical Union meeting one year, a couple of years ago, and they were showing for the first time the pictures, the very high-resolution pictures of the surface of Mars. And they were seeing all of these water washes and this kind of water activity, very, very high energy or a very devastating water erosion on Mars. And these are geologists, so they're not trying to favor anybody or favor any theories, but it's very clear that they were stumped. They were like, where is this coming from? And the reality is that Mars, NASA tries to promote this idea that, oh, on Mars it happened billions of years ago. Well, the problem is that every year Mars experiences vast dust storms, and they're very destructive. A dust storm is a very destructive event, weather event. And so any type of pristine geological features, especially if it's in soft rock, or if it's in gravel, or if it's in sand, any of those would be destroyed very quickly, geologically. A good example on Earth is we have the craters that are made from asteroids that come in, collide with Earth, and they are basically covered over somewhat quickly, geologically. But Mars, we don't have on Earth the type of dust storms they have on Mars. The dust storms on Mars are so massive that they can be seen from Earth. So how do these pristine riverbeds and geological features, water erosion, how do those still exist on Mars if this happened billions of years ago? Well, it doesn't make sense. Of course it doesn't. But they have to have these band-aid theories for everything that is observed out here. At any rate, back to just quickly ending up here with the idea that our pole had shifted. Remember that the mastodons in what we now call Siberia were in a semi-tropical region, and they were moved very rapidly. They died standing up with tropical plants in their throats, undigested. How can any scientist look at that and say, oh, that didn't happen? I don't know. I don't know how that can happen, how this can be eliminated from the textbooks so kids grow up not learning about the most important event in the history of man in terms of religion, in terms of anthropology, in terms of biological evolution, geology. Every aspect of Earth and man has been affected by that. At any rate, it looks like I'm running into my last minute here. Just want to remind you of the mail order address, JMCC PO Box 58, Navarre, N-A-V-A-R-R-E, Minnesota, 55392, I'm sorry, 55392 is the zip code. Where did I get that other one? 55392 is the zip code. JMCC PO Box 58, Navarre, Minnesota, 55392. $17 for one book, The Diamond Principle, $24 for the two books, that includes free shipping. And also, just remember the $299 for the Dalton water filter, something everybody needs these days. This is Jim McCanny, this is my Science Hour, and as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.